Hello, space fans. It is JWST week here at Space Junk Podcast. In fact, I would go so far as to say it is JWST week everywhere, because this week marks the launch, finally, of the James Webb Space Telescope. Now, Dustin and I recorded this episode on Monday. It is now Wednesday. I'm getting ready to post it live, and so the launch has been delayed one more day. It is now being launched as of today on Christmas Day, which is Saturday at 7:20 a.m. And Dustin and I are very excited about it, and we wanted to take some time to share our thoughts on what is perhaps the most important space telescope launch since Hubble. JWST, this week on Space Junk Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from DeepAstronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Space Junk Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the James Webb Space Telescope, because it is really James Webb Space Telescope week here. We're recording this on December 21st at 10:57 a.m., so we are anxiously awaiting the new launch that's scheduled for Christmas Eve on Friday at 7:20 a.m. And so, Dustin, I thought we'd talk about it. Let's get it all out. Let's talk. Let's get our anxieties out in the open. So how are you doing, Dustin?
Good, good. I'm doing very well. It's hard to believe that it's really time.
Isn't it, though?
You know, after all the delays, all the buildup, it's hard to believe it's really time.
Yeah, exactly. It's just crazy, the buildup to this thing. I mean, I've done streams where I've talked about the history of JWST, and it's like this thing started before Hubble launched. So we're talking before 1990. People have been working on this, and it has gone through so many iterations. So, yeah, it's reached mythical proportions. I was just telling you before we started recording, I was reading an article. All of my newsfeed, by the way, is just full of titles of articles like astronomers getting anxious about James Webb Space Telescope launch and all this anxiety that's being produced among astronomers. These are professionals now who are just really like biting their tongues waiting for this thing to happen, because there is a lot at stake, and we'll talk about some of that. And their anxieties are based on a lot of real career either advancing or ending possibilities, depending on what happens here. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the joke was, I was trying to find the tweet before we started recording, but I haven't found it yet. But this is from an NPR article that says, someone on Twitter even joked that anyone nervous about the James Webb Space Telescope colliding with Santa during liftoff, because it's New Year's Eve, should relax, because James Webb launching is just a story we tell children. It's not real. Everybody is skeptical. Also, everybody's a comedian, apparently.
Yeah. So. Do you think it's time? Do you think it's going to happen on Christmas Eve?
I think it will launch very soon. Whether it goes Friday, I don't know. I was joking on my streams that I would start. I wanted to start a pool, you know, like you do in the office, or the like March Madness and stuff, to see when the thing actually launched. But right, the thing that could stop it on Friday is some kind of rocket thing. It won't be a JWST thing, because it's, as of today, it has been mounted in the rocket. It is they put the fairings on Friday, so it's been closed in, and now it's been fueled up. It's got everything going for it. All that's left now is to move the rocket to the launch pad. So anything that would prevent a launch this week, I think, is related to the Ariane 5 rocket.
Can you imagine the checklist that have had to be worked through in the last several months to get this thing into the rocket ready to go?
Oh,
$10 billion.
I know you've got to hang him from wires and cranes, and you're trying to put it in. I tell you whose job I would not want is Greg Robinson's. He's the program manager for JWST, and he's the one who's down there in French Guiana right now, making sure the thing gets put on the rocket properly without dropping it. God,
I just couldn't imagine. Zero room for error on anything. And just, yeah. I mean, how many countless variables in this equation?
Yeah.
And it's just, what an undertaking from the beginning. What an undertaking. And it's changed multiple times. It's such a huge telescope that it has to be folded up. And then they're going to launch it way out there, way past where Hubble was is. And yeah, I just think the whole thing is fascinating, but I don't know nearly enough about it. So let's go through it, because I know you've done a ton of talks on it. And this is something that you've researched, you know, in depth, and you really understand. Yeah,
I worked with the project for 4 years. So this was early on. This was when it was still being built and assembled in Goddard. So I know a lot of the people involved. I've worked with them, and I've followed it, very intensely. So
you're the man to talk to. You've got the answers. Let's talk about it. So first, I'd like to know, especially, you know, for anyone that doesn't have any idea, they have no idea what we're even talking about, which I'd imagine at this point, especially people listening to this podcast, it's probably just a few. But, you know, let's go through it. What is JWST and why? Why was it built? I mean, this is expensive. So why was it built? What gap does it cover?
Well, All of these things are dictated whether or not something gets built, and what astronomers want is as far as telescopes and infrastructure and observatories is all dictated by a document, at least in the United States, that comes out every 10 years called the Decadal Survey. And that's where all astronomers get together and they make a pitch for what is most important. What are the most important questions that we want to answer about the universe, and what equipment will get us there? Everything is always driven by the science. And so when Hubble was launched, it's got a 2.4 meter telescope, a little bit, almost 7 feet in diameter, very big telescope. And it was launched in 1990. Its primary reason, also a decadal survey priority, was to measure the expansion rate of the universe. That's the big thing they wanted to know from Hubble. Well, it did that in like the first year of operation. It figured out a really good, accurate measurement for the expansion rate of the universe. So everything else was gravy as far as scientists were concerned. And there was a lot of gravy, as it turns out, over 30 years, right? I mean, this thing has been repaired 5 times. It was launched on the space shuttle, deployed into a higher low Earth orbit than anything else had been put. The highest level orbit that the space shuttle could reach it was put in. And then it was repaired 5 times. Well, while this was all going on, astronomers said, Hubble's great. It's teaching us a lot. But we need to see the early universe. We need to see the very first stars and galaxies that ever shone. And we're not talking about among the first stars and galaxies. We're talking the first stars to ever shine. And so that's what James Webb was built to do that. And it was built to be put in space because the wavelengths at which these objects are, the very first stars, the very first galaxies, the very first planets and all of that stuff that formed in the early universe, by the time it reaches our solar system, the light from those objects, they have been redshifted into the infrared. And so JWST can only look at the infrared wavelengths. There was some talk early on about making it bigger, but it was descoped in terms of the wavelength range. But it was descoped to decide we're only looking from about a half micron out to about 25 microns. So that's where it's looking. And it's designed to see these because that's where these first objects are shining. And it could do a lot of other things, which we'll talk about, but that's why it was launched. And why is it going to L2? This is a place in our solar system that is a million miles away, 1.5 million kilometers. Everything that is in orbit around each other, like the Earth is in orbit around the Sun, any two objects that are in orbit around each other have these things called Lagrange points. And there's 5 of them. For the Earth and the Moon have 5 Lagrange points. The Sun and the Earth have 5 Lagrange points. And they're located in a podcast, it's hard to describe all that, but they're located in kind of a cross shape. But JWST, these are stable points. These are points of like gravitational stability for various things. Trojan asteroids, for example, they coagulate in the L4 and L5 points. But L2 is a point that sits behind Earth, way past the Moon,
a million miles away, and it follows the Earth as it goes around the sun. All of these Lagrange points do. So it's going to sit at L2 because it's way away, far away from Earth. Earth is too bright and too warm to let JWST get to the temperatures it needs to get to. And it's shielded. It's going to be always pointing out into the outer solar system, away from the sun, out into the outer reaches of space. And it needs to be cold because this is, like I said, an infrared telescope. So it's going to be cooled down to 30 Kelvin. So it's going to be the coldest thing we've ever operated in terms of cameras. All infrared cameras need to be cooled, even here on Earth. But that's why they're putting it where they're putting it. So all of this is driven by science. What they want to learn dictates a telescope that is 6.5 meters in diameter. That's JWST. Huge, right? Big.
So what is that? That's 20 feet roughly, right?
That's right. Yeah. And God, that's all, as we huge. Talked, I know. So think about the resolution capabilities, right? It's going to be able to resolve, not just infer, but actually resolve the disk of planets around other stars. That's what that diameter gets you. Wow. And another reason why this is infrared. So you have a star emitting light on a planet that's in orbit around it. That light is reflecting off of that planet in the infrared, going right at the James Webb Space Telescope, and the disk will be resolved, which is something we can't do now. Hubble can't resolve these objects. So, yeah.
Well, Hubble's only roughly 8 feet. So you're talking about a much, much larger telescope than Hubble.
That's right. That's right. Many, many times.
So I have several questions on everything you just said. The first is about the redshifting. So I don't really understand based on the timing, because how old is the universe? You're talking about the earliest stars. What are we talking? 13 billion years ago?
That's right.
Roughly?
Yeah. About a billion years after the Big Bang, the first stars had already begun to form, and they've begun to coalesce into the very first galaxies that there ever were. So sure. Because the universe is so old, 13.5 billion years, and because light can only travel at 300 centimeters per second, in a vacuum, 300,000, I should say, the speed of light limits how fast the starlight can get to us. And so over the course of 13 billion years, the universe has been expanding. It's been getting bigger all the time. And these first stars, when they were born, were very large and they were very hot. And so they were blue hot giant stars, and they emitted most of their light in the ultraviolet. These were very, very hot. They only lived a million years. So they were very short-lived stars as well. But that ultraviolet light, when it left those stars and traveled through the universe over 13 billion years, as the universe expanded, got bigger, it stretched out space-time, and the apparent recession of all these things through the expanding universe caused the light to be redshifted. And so it left the ultraviolet and was shifted through optical and into the infrared where it sits now. So
why would it have gone further? That's what I don't understand, is if it started UV, I mean, obviously there was also, we're talking about stars. There's going to be visible light. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that would have, because of the time and the expansion of the universe, that would have redshifted out of the visible spectrum into primarily infrared. But with this much time passing, why wouldn't it have shifted further? Why aren't these radio waves?
It's related, I think, to the expansion rate of the universe. So I have to look up the exact rate at which it's expanding, but it's so many megaparsecs per year that it is expanding, and that rate dictates the redshift. So
I mean, that's convenient, though.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that, but if we wait another 13 billion years, I'm sorry, we're looking at it being shifted well into the radio. So it's a combination
the
of the amount
Webb,
of
time. Is it may not be in time. You know, you're saying we only have 13 billion years left and we got to get Webb in the air.
Yeah, I know, right? Time is an issue.
Exactly. We're going to launch it too late, man.
Oh, my God. I know, right? It's like, when are we going to get this thing up? Oh, my God. Everybody. Everybody's having fun with it. Yeah, everybody's a comedian. I know. Yeah, it's we got to hurry it up. We've only got 13 billion years before it redshifts out of the infrared.
And it's useless. It's just a 20-foot gold paperweight.
I know, exactly. At that point, the good news is though we'd have ground-based observatories on the ground. You know, the radio wave telescopes that could see it then. So. Yeah. Poor NASA. Yeah. You know, in NASA's defense, and you always say this, Dustin, go big or go home. That's what you say, right? Well, NASA has got to have balls the size of Jupiter to try this. You want to talk about putting, you know, going for it. I mean, this is, people say NASA is a conservative organization. I disagree. I mean, look at the cojones that's required to spend this kind of money on stuff. Talk about putting all of your eggs in one basket. I think this is a bold move. Now, yeah, I don't think NASA will ever do it again.
You know, I don't. So I definitely don't. I don't think that NASA deserves the criticism they get. They get attacked from every political angle that you possibly can, because humanity doesn't always want what's best for itself. Right. You know, I mean, in any case, I just went back and I was watching the first, you know, global warming pitches, the real ones, like when Carl Sagan was addressing, what was it, the House, I guess, or the Senate? I don't remember exactly what it was, but, you know, back he was just kind of giving his spiel. That was 1985 that he was begging for help. 1985 saying, look, we can fix this, but it's got to be now. Yeah. Right. And you look at it and it's like, what's happened since? Well,
More people are saying that it's not a hoax. At least we've got that, right? We've got more people not denying it.
That's just because there are a couple billion more people.
That's the law of averages, so, I know.
Yeah, it averages out. But I mean, seriously, though, I think NASA does such a good job, especially when they're getting attacked from every angle, of still somehow navigating that. And, you know, bringing this type of technology to the forefront and making science that isn't just specifically like war technology. This is for the good of humanity, understanding our place in the universe, and putting these, just like you said, rolling the dice in huge ways, with the only possible benefit being that humanity has a better understanding of our place in the universe. And, you know, and then spin off technologies from that to improve human life. But NASA has no interest. It's not, you know, it's not specifically like the DOD or anything like that. It's like the interest is not, well, let's put this up there so we can put missiles on it. You know,
exactly. Yeah.
It's like, this is going to improve our understanding of the universe, and the things that come from that will improve human well-being. And so I don't think NASA deserves any of the hate or the criticism they get for even these types of delays. It's better to delay it. I wish they would have delayed Hubble a little bit to test the damn thing.
It was delayed a lot, but you're right. It would have been nice to have figured out that spherical aberration.
Test it on the ground. Test it on the ground. Don't send it up and then have to send somebody chasing after it, you know, and reverse engineer it after the fact, the problem. You know, it's like, hey, man, take your time. You spent $10 billion. It's a lot of money. It's, you know, it's really important that this thing work. Take your time. I wouldn't care if they had to delay it another 6 months to make sure that when it goes up, it's right.
Yeah, the whole thing is driven by science. It's not driven by any of the other practical considerations of you know, like you said, the military uses it. They're not thinking about that. It comes, a lot of this technology spinoff comes as a result of the invention of some of the things required to get the science questions answered. But that's not the driver. The driver is the science. And you know, luckily, NASA, the stakes are very high. And I mean, NASA, luckily, I think in a good way, has been split up into two main parts. There's the human exploration part, which is what's handling the Artemis program, the ISS, all of that's
also
handling
very
the human.
Exciting.
Exactly. And then they have the science directorate. And that's run by Thomas Zurbuchen. And that's the part of NASA that handles the Mars rovers, the voyages to the Voyager probes, the New Horizons, all the robotic probes, what's going to Europa in a couple of years. It handles HST and it's handling JWST. That if JWST fails, and there are hundreds of single points of failure, these are things that if any one of these hundreds of things happen, the mission's done. It will not succeed. If any one of those things fail, And so, and Thomas Verboeken has said that if this does fail, it's going to put the science directorate back 20 years. Yeah. Because that's how much is at stake here. And we're talking, again, Mars rovers, going to other planets, all of this stuff is handled by this directorate. So there's a lot at stake. And I don't think anybody knows risk management better than NASA. Maybe there are, but NASA has, I think, I don't know much about how they manage and mitigate risks, but they have eliminated all of the risks, according to them, that would, that makes them feel uncomfortable. And all the risks that remain are manageable. So that's where we are. That's why it's getting launched. And like I said, this takes balls, man. This takes,
many unknowns.
Yeah.
You know, it can be brought down by a single fragment flying through space that just hits it wrong. You know, it can be like anything can go wrong. And that's the terrifying piece. And like you were saying, NASA doesn't get do-overs with this stuff. It's like, if this doesn't work, it's not like the public's going to say, you know what? Yeah, go ahead and spend another $10 billion and just make it again. That's not going to happen. They're not going to get public support for that. They have to be right every time.
It's unfortunate because those same people might not have any problem whatsoever with a $700 billion, with a B, annual that we spend every year, money, budget on military. And yet this is the cost of one aircraft carrier. And that's got people up in arms. I get it. It's expensive. That's a lot of money. I don't care who you are, but that is, you know, there are comparisons to make here with which is a better use of our money. And so,
well, fear is a powerful motivator for anyone, you know, and, seeing the instability in the world, I understand people's, hesitancy to pull any money away from military spending. And, you know, I get it. The world is, has been
I do too.
Tense. It's tense.
Of course.
And you want to have a powerful nation that can protect your freedoms. Like, I totally understand that. And I'm not speaking out against that in any way.
I'm not either. I want to be clear
I'm
on
just
that
more
too.
Pro NASA. Whatever we can do to get NASA. This is why you don't make me the president, because I'd be like, all right, we're giving NASA everything.
All right, tell me about it. I know, right? I'm the same way. What you need, NASA?
What you NASA, need? NASA and the school systems. You're getting everything, and then whatever's left over, we're going to divvy out. But
hell, man, I'd vote for that.
We're
going to
educate.
Dude.
We are going to educate, you know, and we're going to put all our eggs in that basket.
I couldn't agree more. I'm with you. I'd vote for you, Dustin. You need to run.
We vote for each other. We each get one vote.
You know? Well, you know, I tried to find out accurate numbers for what Hubble cost, and I adjusted for $1990 and or $2020 or whatever they do with that stuff. And the numbers that I found said that the Hubble project cost $4.5 billion in today's dollars to launch, which is roughly half of what we spent on a JWST. And the total mission cost over 30 years has gone to $13 billion. So remember that included five repair missions and 30 years of operations. So, I mean, we're kind of comparing apples to apples here. Yes, JWST is expensive. It's twice as much as what Hubble cost. Will it give us twice as much scientific return? I don't know that that's the right way to look at it, but I think, yes, it will.
I don't think it is the right way to look at it. I think these are expensive questions, and every human that's ever existed on Earth has asked these philosophical questions. And, you know, I believe in science just through and through. I think that, I mean, and it's because my passion is and always has been philosophy is the reason I support science so much. I think science is the doorway, it's the pathway to answering those philosophical questions. You want to know where we came from, who we are, where we are, when we are? Build the JWST. It's the next step in that direction. And those are expensive questions to answer, but I can't imagine a better way to spend our existence, our very brief existence here on Earth, than trying to answer those very important questions that still don't have answers. And every human that's ever lived has asked the questions.
Yeah, you and I are cut from the same cloth. I definitely agree with that statement. And you to put a dollar figure on that is practically necessary. I understand that we've got to figure out how we're going to pay for this, but to figure out what it's worth, I don't think it's one of those like MasterCard things. It's priceless, right? What are you going to, you know, how are you going to price to put a price tag on human?
Even if you don't answer the question, but you just take the next step, this will have been worth it, in my opinion, 10 times sure. over. I think Hubble, you got 100 times more out of Hubble than the cost of it. You know, I mean, understanding even just the simple fact, like even just the pointing it into nothingness and seeing the thousands of galaxies pop up and understanding the scale of our universe, before that image, we did not understand that.
Yeah.
Right? A single image changed the way that all of humanity forever from that point forward could look at the universe and understand our place in it with a yeah. single image. That image was worth the cost of Hubble.
The Hubble Deep Field changed my life. It did. And I'm not overstating yeah. it when I say that. So yes, I totally agree with that statement. And later today, I'm doing a stream on where I talk about JWST versus Hubble. And I was going to do a segment on all of the things that Hubble has done. And I, you know, there's no stream long enough for that. It's, no. but the, you know, the right. most important part of it was the deep fields, right? The deep fields that came out of Hubble were just completely humanity changing. We got, yeah, wow.
I don't even know that I agree it's the most important part. You know, I think what Hubble did better than any other mission that I've seen, other than of course the moon landings, was get the public's attention. Those big, beautiful images that had less scientific value than what Hubble was really made to do was the best PR move in history for yeah. NASA,
yeah.
right? Like those big, beautiful images made people understand, like, this is your universe. This yeah. stuff is out there, right? And we're taking pictures of it, and we're doing it because you support NASA, because this stuff is available, you know, because before, it's so easy to take these things for granted, like the deep field. I mean, everybody's seen that image now, and you can see, like, we are in a very, very vast universe. And you see that image and you're like, okay, well, I've seen it. I understand it. I internalized it. I now have that as part of my understanding. But the thing is, without Hubble, that doesn't exist. And we That's don't right. know these things. And so we yeah. take for granted after the fact that you had to roll the dice with $4 billion to gain that next step in understanding. And so I just don't think there's any way to measure the value of these things. And when we're talking about cost of $4 billion and $10 billion, it's so much money. There's no way to say it's not a lot of money, but I don't think there's a better value on human spending, especially when you look at the ways we spend $10 billion on a weekly basis on other programs that mm-hmm. are proven not to work.
Yeah, yeah.
that I know. Repeatedly I know. Prove themselves to lose money and not work. Yeah. You know, that give humanity nothing back except for, you know, more aggression between the left and the right and the right and the left. You know, it's like instead we could be focusing our energies here. And I think we should be. And I don't mean this to be a political statement as much as I do just a, hey, support science in general yeah. statement. Because again, the one thing I think is most important for all of us moving forward, especially if we're going to solve the problems that are the real problems, like I've told you a million times, I think the real war for humanity is not with each other. It's with relevance. If we want to solve those problems, we better yeah. get on the same damn page and start attacking this the way we need to, because these are yeah. big, big questions.
Yeah, it's existential. And these sorts of maneuvers, these sorts of advances that we put forth, advance that in many, many ways. The value question is one that is absolutely unquantifiable, right? You know, what value are we going to place on these endeavors? And I think that they are, you know, they're priceless. They really are. You can't yeah. put a value on that. It's absolutely worth doing. You know, the over the years, all the Hubble stuff that we've come to expect and appreciate will manifest itself in a different way with JWST. But because it's a infrared telescope, we're going to get different views, different images, mm-hmm. different kinds of deep fields. The deep field from, I think the real change that we're going to see with JWST that was analogous to what the deep fields did for us with Hubble is going to be the very first image of an exoplanet that we can actually resolve. I think mm-hmm. it won't be a pretty picture. It'll be grainy. It'll be full of noise.
That's what I'm worried about, is that it won't be a pretty picture.
Really? Well, the mm-hmm. Hubble wasn't, the deep fields weren't pretty. They were just blobs, right? They were, the galaxies in those were just dots and specks. But once you understood that those dots and specks were entire galaxies, then that image took on a different meaning.
There was still a ton of color. and you could see the shapes of what was there, and you could tell what you were looking at. You know, what I worry about is that it's a little too, you know, you're not viewing it the way we view everything else in optical wavelengths. It's like,
yeah,
or in the visible spectrum anyway. It's like, man, when you see it and you can recognize it, it's one thing. But when you're looking at something that just looks like instrumentation, you know, imagery, it's a lot harder to understand. And that's one of the things I worry about. I think that's why the image of the black hole, we should still be talking about that every day.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. You weren't totally impressed with what they released, the image,
you know,
of that.
And we joked about it.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's really hard to look at that and to feel the way you do about it, this, like the same way that you do about Hubble images, because Hubble images, we understand. The other one looks like, well, you know, I don't get what I'm looking at. Why is it so blurry? Why is it fuzzy? Why isn't it pretty? Why isn't it resolved well? Like, I don't understand it. And I think that's why it got everybody's attention, because we knew what we were seeing was something that only humanity pushing itself as far as possible could ever do. And that's amazing. And so like that gathered steam, and I think that's perfect, but because it's not a pretty image, we're not all still talking about it every single day. And yeah. What else has happened in the last couple of years, other than the craziness of COVID, that trumps that right now?
Yeah. So your argument is that because the M87 image from the Event Horizon telescope, wasn't more spectacular, than that didn't get as much attention as it should have.
Doesn't hold attention the way it should.
Yeah, I guess I have to disagree, because I think these pictures are the context matters, and I think that the fact that they aren't some beautiful detailed image goes in its favor, because the first thing people complain about when they see Hubble images, especially the spectacular ones, is they say that it's fake. It's not real. Right. And because it looks too good. And so you get that other end of the argument, you know, where this is just not pretty enough, or it's too pretty. And then you got the ones that, you know, think it's just a blob. I think the context is everything. I think that the fact that you're looking directly at the event horizon of a black hole, as imaged by telescopes the size of the Earth, is a pretty powerful statement. But you need to know the context for you. Wearing a t-shirt with M87 black hole on it, you know, it just looks like a target. But, you know, the context, I think, is important there.
I think there's a perspective shift, though. And I think there's a gap there. You know, I'd imagine that, like, think about the way that people that have been on the ISS and looked back at the Earth see the Earth afterwards, compared to someone standing next to them that has no idea, that's just lived a normal life, never seen it, you know, maybe seen pictures, but never been up there and experienced it. Or even simpler, imagine two people standing on the coast right at the Pacific, one person who's traveled the world and seen everything that the world has to offer, and the other person that's never left that town right there on the coast, and they're standing next to each other looking out. What they see, even though they're looking at the same exact ocean, are two very different things. And what I worry about is that with these images being what they are, that it's not going to be able to communicate to the people that aren't well-traveled in science.
Yeah. Yeah, I do see your point. But remember, have you seen Hubble? Hubble now is an infrared telescope. It has very limited optical capabilities. Have you seen the infrared view of the Horsehead Nebula?
I have. I think it's the best one of the Horsehead, honestly.
Isn't that amazing, right? So. Yeah. To say, you know, because an infrared telescope will give us pretty pictures, and certainly JWST will, in the infrared, the level of detail
that
you're
doing, though, is it?
Like, yeah,
it's not got, doing anything that local.
It will. I mean, to look at exoplanets, to image the atmospheres or to take the spectra of atmospheres of exoplanets, that's all going to be within our galaxy. So we're going to be looking at lots of stuff inside the Milky Way with JWST. It's not just, I mean, its primary science driver is to understand the early universe. So it's not just going to return pictures of, you know, irregular shaped galaxies and old stars. Right. It will look at plenty of places within our own galaxy, and the resolution that it will offer there in nearby objects will be astonishing. And it'll look at the infrared in the Andromeda galaxy. Yeah, and maybe, you can be sure of that.
Maybe I misunderstand the scope of this plan, but I didn't realize it was going to be doing anything. Like, I mean, look, if it takes the same, even that same picture, can you imagine the resolution on the Horsehead Nebula with sure. JWST? It would yeah. be unbelievable. It would be like nothing we've ever seen before.
Right. So on Hubble, 20% of Hubble's time is called director's discretionary time. 20%. That's a lot. And that means that the director of the Space Telescope Science Institute has direct influence over what Hubble looks at and can decide that to look at this thing. That's how the first Hubble Deep Field was taken, because no astronomer wanted to risk their time looking at a blank spot of sky where they didn't think anything was. No, but the director said, I'll use some of my time to do this. And I will look at this blank spot in the sky near the Big Dipper and image it for 11 days. And it did, and we got the deep field. There will be director time on JWST where it won't cost a scientist. Every scientist, every astronomer has to justify their use of these telescopes. They have to have a science need. And that need is verified or ratified by a time allocation committee that says, yes, this is worth using JWST for. We'll give you 10 orbits. Go for it. And that's how it's decided. So you can be sure that some of this discretionary time will be used on things just like that. M80 or M31, some of the Messier objects, Crab Nebula, all of these things I think will be imaged by JWST over time. They need to get their science observations in first, and that'll be interspersed with some other things that are less scientifically driven. So that's how it'll work out. And I think we'll get a lot of really amazing pictures from it.
I mean, how... So you said there's a panel that decides who's going to get what time, right?
That's right, yeah.
I wonder how that... I mean, who's on that panel, first off?
Members of the JWST science team at the Space Telescope Science Institute. It's called the Time Allocation Committee. And everybody gives a proposal. They have a season. They call them cycles. Cycle one has already been decided for JWST. So the first year of observations has already been planned out. And then I don't know what the schedule is for JWST. A lot of it depends on when it launches, but every year they meet and they look at all the proposals that have been submitted. And of course, they have way more proposals than there is time for, and they select the ones that will make the cut. And that's how it's decided.
Yeah.
But the director has 20%, which is pretty amazing amount of time. That's a wealth of telescope time, and the discretion that they use is primarily for things that wouldn't make sense for an astronomer to apply to use JWST for. But it's still a good use.
Do we know yet what what's the first thing that they're going after? Do we know the plan?
Yeah, they do. I should look that up. I don't know it off the top of my head, but if you go to the Space Telescope Science Institute's webpage, stsci.edu, there will be a whole section on the proposal cycles and what proposals have been accepted. It's going to be in scientific jargon, but you'll be able to see all of the observations that are coming out. And another thing that happens with this is that the data that are taken from that are usually embargoed for 1 year. And people get upset about that, but that's to give the astronomer a chance to write their paper before the data become public. And then anybody can have access to it. And, if you think about it, astronomers applying for time, they put out the proposal to make these observations. They spent the money on the on building the proposal and applying for time to make this, to write their paper. They need to be given time, I think, to do that. And they're given a year usually. And some are let go right away, depending on the program. A year after they've been taken, they become available to the public. All of this will be stored on the MAST archive, which is the Mikulski archive for space telescopes. All of the data are going to be there. You can go there right now at mast.stsci.edu and get any Hubble data you want now. That same will be true with JWST. So
JWST has four cameras on it. Is that right?
It has four instruments, two of which are cameras. There's the near cam. That's the near infrared camera, which will be looking at it between half a micron and 5 microns. That is going to be the workhorse of JWST. And then there's MIRI, the mid-infrared imager, that will look between 5 microns and 25, I think, something like that. It's in the 20s, way out into the mid-infrared. That one, those two are going to be the one we get all of the images from. And then there are spectrographs. There's the near spec, the near infrared spectrometer, which will look at the spectra of the light coming through a planet's atmosphere, and we'll be able to see using what elements are in an atmosphere of an exoplanet. So this is where they'll be looking for biosignatures or technosignatures of any kind for different exoplanets. That's going to be huge. That's going to provide a lot of valuable data, but it'll be spectrographic data, not images. And then there's the fine guidance sensor, and that's the sensor that's being used basically as an automatic guider, and it does high resolution pointing of the telescope, and that will also produce images as well, again in the near infrared, so the zero from half micron to about 5 microns.
I've never been to this website. This is a pretty great website, stsci.edu.
Yeah, they're going to operate JWST. That's where I worked, and they also are currently operating Hubble. So, yeah, it's a great place. It's a lot of cool stuff there. And they also have weekly, I'll just give them a quick plug, on Tuesday evenings, they have the first Tuesday of every month, they have a public talk that they live stream on their YouTube channel, so you can check that out. I got them on YouTube when they were just
2 days, 19 hours, 41 minutes, and 53 seconds.
You're looking at the countdown, aren't you?
I'm looking at the countdown.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources for web. There's also jwst.nasa.gov and webtelescope.org. All of those places are run by NASA in a confusing way, but they're all there, giving you all the nitty gritty. So they launch nominally this Friday at the December 24th at 7:20 a.m. Eastern Time. So here's hoping, right? I'll be there. I'll be live streaming on my channel. So if you want to join me, you can hop in and we'll watch this thing together. I would not be surprised if it gets delayed maybe by a day or two. Just because of launch stuff. You know how when you watch a SpaceX launch, sure, they always like, you know.
Well, we're close enough now that they should have some idea on whether or not the weather is going to permit launch. I'm guessing that it still looks go because they haven't changed the site.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything either. Usually about 3 days prior, which will be about now, they should be making decisions on the weather. Yeah, so all this is going to be – that's going to be the thing that affects, I think, the launch. And, of course – the two big milestones to watch immediately after that is going to be the fairing separation. That's going to happen a half an hour after the thing launches, and the solar array deployment. That's going to happen within an hour of launch. So those two things have to happen right away. If either one of them fail, the mission fails. The fairings have to leave. That's probably going to happen. But then the solar arrays have to deploy about a half an hour after launch to give power to everything. So if that doesn't happen, then the mission's a failure. So that's right away. That's first day of operations. And then everything else takes place. The deployment's going to take a month. It's going to take about 29 days to unfold everything and to get a million miles out to the L2 point. So we got a month after launch before things are fully deployed. And any one of those 300 things I was telling you about, if they fail, the mission's over.
So, and are there, so it takes about a month, but how often are the next stages happening? Things that, you know, to look out for, oh, they're going to, you know, unfold the mirror assembly.
Yeah, that's all laid down. I love this. They have a deployment explorer at jwst.nasa.gov, and there's the entire the deployment sequence there that you can look at, and you can click on any of these stages of the deployment, and it'll tell you when it's going to happen. And there's sometimes there's a video that shows you what the deployment will look like at each stage. So like I'm pointing on something now that says there's a mid-course correction burn launch plus 2 days. These are going to be launch correction burns that get things out to the L2 properly. There's another one about deploying the tower assembly. That's going to happen 4 days after launch. So, you know, all of these different things is already available at jwst.nasa.gov. Lots of resources there. They've really done a good job, actually. There's a countdown page, which you were just on. Explore the deployments. That's the page I'm on. You can keep track of everything along the way.
Yeah, if you haven't seen these sites, definitely check them out. It's pretty amazing what they've put together here and the presentation of it. It's a lot of science websites, the way everything's laid out is almost like an essay you don't want to read. It's not like that at all.
Yeah,
this is a fun website to explore, and a lot of pictures and visual representation of what's happening instead of just, the engineer speak. So
yeah, they've done a good job. It's really a good, well-designed website. My problem with NASA websites is just they seem to be scattered all over the place. Like the main one I use these days is jwst.nasa.gov, but that's different than webtelescope.org, which is also something they operate. It's also different than spacetelescopes.org, which is what ESA operates. And then finally there's stsci.edu, which also has web news and Hubble news. So which one do you go to? It can be really confusing. So I don't like that. But once you've sorted all through that stuff, there's a lot of good content out there.
So how involved is CSA and ESA in this?
The Canadian Space Agency built the Fine Guidance Sensor Camera. And ESA, of course, the European Space Agency, has the launch. They've also contributed to, I think it was the NearSpec. There's these really cool shutters over the detector of the NearSpec spectrometer that lets you selectively open and close shutters that are basically over each pixel. They're like 9-micron shutters, and you can open and close different shutters to, like, for example, block out the light from a star. So imagine you had a camera on your telescope at home with the ability to block out one star, the light from one star. Imagine the kind of imaging you could do without that bright thing ruining, all the other pixels in the area. So, ESA had a big part in developing that. So that's the
rules. Sounds incredible. It sounds like the best tech ever. It also sounds terrifying to have this thing that far away with that many mechanical parts, even for just the shutter.
Yeah, that's true. But, people have been asking me lately, and I got one I'm going to talk about a little bit later in one of my streams coming up, is that what are some of the spinoff technologies from JWST for amateur astronomers? And this is the one that I think is coming down the pike. I think that cameras that are going to be available to amateurs will have, overlaying the detector, a grid of pixel size shutters over each one that will be open and closed. You'll be able to manipulate them yourself. I think that's coming. I think that's a spinoff technology that will trickle down to amateur devices at some point. I also think the ability to image in the infrared will improve. Unfortunately, the atmosphere is just going to make that not practical.
Right.
So
yeah, but getting things to space is getting, it's only getting less expensive at this point.
That's right. Thanks to SpaceX and those guys, they are making the cost of launches a lot less. I don't know what the cost of the Ariane 5 is going to be. It's probably the $1 billion range.
There's nothing about this that's going to be cheap. camera tech, though, is just, I really think for people, the photographers already know this because you witness it every single day. It's kind of like it was with computers, or still is with computers. Don't get too attached, because in a year, yours will be outdated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And cameras are that way. Looking at all the new tech that's rolling out with Sony, Sony's doing such an incredible job, because they left a really, really big gap when they shut down their CCD production and went specifically to CMOS only. That left a huge gap, and especially in the scientific community, where CCD still dominates for a lot of reasons. But everybody's having to make the switch to CMOS. But looking at some of the new chips and the new technologies, like even Foveon, I'm still the biggest Foveon sensor fanboy because are you familiar with Foveon?
I was going to just say, I've never heard of it.
So it's really underdeveloped right now. It's still at the earliest stages of development, and it doesn't have the funding it needs to take off quickly. But it's basically a monochrome style chip that reads out in color. You know, the problem with color cameras is that they have a Bayer matrix.
Right.
So RGGB pattern repeating over and over with filters over each individual pixel. The problem with that is filters keep light out. They don't attract light from other areas to bring it in. And so if you have a red pixel and green light hits it, it rejects it. And right. So, you know, right out of the gate, you're going to lose at least half your red light because, or 75% of your red light, because only one out of every four pixels has a red filter on it, right? That's the Bayer matrix, RGGB.
Yeah.
And so when you're looking at space and everything's hydrogen emission, you know, and all your light's coming in red, that's not a great thing that half your pixels are covered in green and then the other quarter is covered in blue and only a quarter is covered in red. It's not a great thing. And so they have what's called interpolation, which has gotten really good, but it basically guesses at the spots in between, you know, using the red pixels that do get light, it can guess to fill in the gaps in between. And that's how your cell phone works. That's how all color cameras work. Foveon technology is a little bit different. Think of every single photo site registering all light, just the same way it does with the monochrome chip. But the way that it works is they measure it at layers of depth. So they say, how far did the light penetrate the silicon cell? And knowing that the different properties of the wavelengths, like red wavelengths are longer, they penetrate deeper into the cell than, for instance, blue, which hits and stops at the surface. So they say, everything that stopped at the surface of this, measure that out or read that out as blue. Everything in the middle, green, and everything that went deep into the silicon is going to be red. But that way you get the full benefit of every single photo site for every single color, increasing the sensor's ability by, you know, a minimum of 75% or more. You know, so it's really, really great technology. The problem is the noise in the sensors is out of control. I've actually owned one of these sensors and used it. And it's, if you're in an area with a ton of light and you don't have to push the ISO, it's absolutely unbelievable. The images look three-dimensional. There's 3D images. You know, right now, if you're in a low light area, they're basically useless. You cannot push the ISO above 100. Just super, super noisy when you get into low light situations, and the tech just has a long way to go. But in general, I think the concept is amazing. And if they can improve those sensors, I could see that being, you know, an industry changing tech.
Yeah, that sounds great, because I know that Bayer matrices would never fly in the professional realm because of that interpolation you're talking about. There's no – that invents data or it destroys data, and that's just not acceptable in a scientific image. But this might work. Although, did you say that how does it decide what red is again? Say that again.
All right. So let's say you had a bucket of sand. That's each photo site. Right.
Right.
Every single photo site's a bucket of sand, and you're dropping three different types of things, three different weights into the sand. You would be able to measure based on the ones that could penetrate all the way to the bottom of the bucket. You would say those are all red.
Okay.
The ones that stop in the center, it's all green.
Got it. Okay. So that's using the band gap of silicon to decide the energy of the photon hitting it. And from there, it gives you the color. I get it. Okay. Wow.
Exactly. And then everything that stops on the surface. Because, you know, of the sharp wavelength, the very short wavelength of blue light, they're like, well, everything that stops there, collect it up. It's all blue. We know it's all blue.
That would be a deep mother of a pixel, though, wouldn't it? To get that at any kind of accuracy.
And I don't know. I don't know the well depth on these pixels. But it is an interesting question. And, you know, I know it has a long way to go, but the concept, I think, is fascinating. Because even if you have to redesign what sensors look like and how they operate, that tech has the potential, like I said, to change the way we do digital photography.
That's amazing. Yeah. So once they work out the noise issues, that sounds like a real promising thing. I'll keep my eye out for it.
I think the problem has been that the wrong company owns it. Sigma, the camera company, owns that technology. And really, it's unfortunate because it should have been somebody that could mega fund it, like Sony, you know, that could really get behind it and push it forward. Because I think it's going to take a lot of funding to push it where it needs to be. But Sigma doesn't, they've had it for years, and it doesn't seem like they have either the financial backing or the interest in pushing that forward with the other projects they have going on. So I think they need to get somebody to put some money behind it.
Yeah, it sounds like they could license that technology to somebody with deeper pockets, maybe, and right. and get that developed. Well, that's a good idea. Okay, well, we got about 10 minutes left of this episode, and Dustin and I wanted to go over a question we got, because we get a lot of direct feedback from our listeners as much as we'd like. So whenever we do get a question, I want to make sure that we address it on the podcast. And this one is an email I received today from Eric. And he is asking about Stellina. He's trying to decide whether to get a Stellina or an EV scope for an astronomy club. And let me just read his email. Firstly, I want to thank you very much for your great reviews on YouTube and Space Junk for the two smart telescopes of Stellina and EV scope. I'm running a mobile planetarium and giving an astronomy workshop in the school where I'm also working as a music teacher. As a visual astronomer, I try to show my students as much of the night sky as possible. All the bright objects are great, but with deep sky objects, right after the Andromeda Galaxy and M42, it's getting difficult. I feel you, man. I think Stellina or EV scope would be a great addition to star parties because I probably wouldn't have the possibility to test these scopes. I would like to hear your opinion on which you would recommend for exactly this purpose. And there's three questions. Which of the two scopes give better image quality? Is the EV scope considerably faster because of the aperture, F4 versus F5? And do you have experience how it is to share the images through the other connected smartphones? Thank you in advance for your help in finding the right telescope. This is great. I love this.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think there's a single, what do you think, Dustin? I don't think there's a single telescope grouping like these two that are better suited for star parties.
It's tough. It'd be tough to find, especially if you're considering setup time. No, there's nothing that touches it. Setup time on both of these is basically set it down and turn it on and you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. It's almost, I mean, it really is that easy. A child can set these up without help, no problem. They're not big, bulky systems. So no, for going out, if you want zero effort, of zero learning curve, just set it, forget it. Have fun and watch the images roll in on the app. Yeah, these are the way to go. As far as which one's better, they're very different user experiences. I've used both and I really enjoyed both. I would say for the person that's a little more a tinkerer, somebody that wants to be involved in a deeper way, I'd say the Unistellar, I felt that with, because you can do things like collimate it, you know, focus it, all those things. The Stellina is really committed to the make this turnkey for the end user. And then you don't have to do any of that. You just turn it on and tell it what you want to see. But they are two different experiences. Both provide you amazing images and let you explore the night sky. So it's hard to say that, you know, one's necessarily better. To address the question of speed of the telescopes, I mean, that's measurable. You can look at the f-stop scale. Basically, you're doubling the light with each step up in the scale, and the scale repeats in this way. So you start at f1.4 and then go to f2, and then basically you skip one every time. I mean, it's the easiest way to explain it is, you know, double the 1.4 and it's going to give you your next step, right? So 1.4 to 2, but if you double 1.4, then you're going to be at 2.8. So after 2 is 2.8. Then go back and double the 2, that's going to give you your next step, which is 4. Right. And then you can go from the first one and you're at 5.6. And that tells you, but each step up. So 1.4 to 2 is doubling the light. So when you're at 4, the next doubling would be 5.6. So when you're at F5, you're about halfway there. So you're not quite doubling the light, but, you know, you're pretty close. And yeah, it's a significant enough difference to notice, you know, slight exposure differences. But neither one of those feels like they're slow in the first place. So I wouldn't say that I would make my buying decision based on that. I mean, the difference is measurable, but it's not something that's going to give you a lot of experience. Like, it's not going to hinder your experience at all in by owning one or the other.
Yeah, I think you might get a slightly different field of view with the EV scope. Mm-hmm. But I actually look at the open-ended. So I used early generations of both of these scopes. They've since come out with newer telescopes I have not used. But of the two first ones, the EV scope was open-tubed. You're right. It was a reflector. And the Stellina is a refractor. And you're right. It's kind of like Apple versus Microsoft, right? It's like on the one hand, Apple keeps everything closed and you need to use your iPod with iTunes or it doesn't work right. That's kind of the approach that Stellina the Veonis company has taken. And the EV scope is a little more geared towards citizen science. It was a definite emphasis on that. So for a star party, I like the Stellina better because the experience to a casual observer is going to be better. The app is much less buggy when I used it than the Unistellar was. All of this could have been worked out by now, as far as I know. I haven't used it recently. So your star party is going to require two things. You set up the scope, Dustin just said, you turn it on and that's it. But then you get your attendees have to download the app on their phone. And you can all share the experience right there. You can even have the telescope outside while you're inside, staying warm. And you can share the experience that way. And you can all decide what you want to look at. You can all get copies of the pictures that are easy to share on everybody's social media. I think that experience from an app perspective was better on the Veonis app than the Unistellar app. But again, with the caveat that this could have changed and gotten better. And so the images that you see on your smartphone is going to depend on your smartphone, the kind of display you have. All of the images will be processed and stacked as you go. Like, let's say you're looking at the Andromeda Galaxy. It'll sit there and stack the images for you, and you'll watch as it gradually builds up detail on your smartphone. How good that experience is and how much detail you can see will depend a lot on your smartphone. But you can save that image as a FITS image and later go back if you're a real nerd. Most people won't do this, but they go home and they could process that FITS data themselves to get better stuff. So I don't know, if I had to pick one and cost wasn't an option, I'd probably go with Stellina. What about you, Dustin?
Well, if cost isn't the problem, I think I'm just getting both.
Okay. I like what you think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's really idea. It's really tough. I would say the thing to look at is, which type of user are you? Do you want it to do everything for you? If so, get the Stellina. If you want to be a little more involved and have, you know, your hands on a little bit more, get the Unistellar. If you're more scientifically oriented, get the Unistellar. If you're more, I want these pretty pictures and to share, sharing is really what it's about. You want to post these to social media, get the Stellina.
If I'm not mistaken, I think they both use Sony sensors. But I'm not totally sure about that. I'm
pretty sure they
that.
Do, but I don't believe it's the same sensor.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Yeah. And of course, the optics are different. On the one hand, you've got a reflector versus a refractor of the same rough diameter. I'm just more attracted to the refractors these days. For that reason. So I think image quality is going to be better with the Veonis Stellina than the Unistellar EV scope. But I don't. It's like when you buy these really high end earphones. For me, I can never tell the difference between a $500 headphone and a $100 headphone. They all sound pretty good to me. So I don't know, when I'm looking at things on my smartphone, both of these images looked more or less the same, especially to a casual observer who's just attending your star party because you are running a school night thing or something like that. They're going to love either one. So, but it's a good thing. Yeah, I think
they both do such a good job. The one you end up with is the one you're going to like, honestly. The one you get comfortable using is the one that you're going to know and the one you're going to enjoy more. I think whichever one you start with is the one that you would say is the better one, because they're both really great products that simplify it to an unbelievable level. You know, from the beginning, we've been telling people there's a huge gap in astronomy for products that just simplify the experience for everyone. And then these two came out and we were really excited about it. And
yeah,
unfortunately, when they came out, it got a lot of hate from, you know, the hardcore, well, I suffered for 20 years. You should suffer too. Don't use that garbage. It's too easy. You know?
Yeah, there's this need for suffering for some reason. Yeah. It's like, well, you must suffer.
Yeah. I had to sit out in the snow, and now you're taking these images that are better than mine. Shut up. Shut up and go away. Nobody cares. Go back in the snow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it's, I guess I will say one more thing about the EV scope, though. I did like that there is a built-in, relatively robust citizen science community already there that surround itself around the EV scope. So since you said you're running a portable planetarium, I used to do that too. And you're also a teacher. This is a good way to get students to do citizen science with the scope. I'm not saying you can't do it with Stellina. You can, but I'm just saying that Frank Marchis and those other guys that have built the scope from Unistellar they're all scientists themselves. Frank is an astronomer at SETI, and he, is interested in doing science with these things. So you have a built-in community there where I don't think there is one of those for Vionis, but there could be. I just happen to be impressed by that. They're measuring asteroid occultations. They're doing, interesting things like that. They're telling each other when a cool thing is happening that they can measure, and they all point their scopes at it. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah. These are hardcore astronomers on both sides. It's not like, that's what's funny is that the astronomers that get all upset about it, it's like, oh, really? It's not for astronomers? That's weird that the people setting this up work at SETI.
Yeah, I know, right?
You know?
Strange.
Do you work at SETI? I didn't know. I didn't know. I thought you were just on cloudy nights, you know, poking fun at everybody else that's doing what you're talking about. So,
exactly.
Yeah, these are hardcore astronomers putting this stuff out there, and it's great. These products are great. Like, don't think that you're going to get it and be disappointed in the way that, you know, a handful of people on forums are saying it's not challenging enough. It's not about the challenge. Go explore the universe. That's where the magic happens. Go share the universe with people. That's what it's about. And these tools do a phenomenal, phenomenal job of that. And that's why you'll see the reviews on these products are overwhelmingly positive. The people that actually bought them and tried them, just like what we're both saying, I was nothing. Look, I've used literally just about every telescope that exists, you know, and I can tell you the first time I used it, it was a magical experience. But like, this is so refreshing to see. And this is something I will keep just for days where I don't want to do a 10 or 20 minute setup. I just want to share with my friends or let them use it. And they have no experience or no interest in learning the ins and outs of astronomy. They just want to see something right now and just have a good night, you know, and that's where it ends up being. It's a very social telescope. People set it up, they have some drinks around it, and it's all, the images are coming to everybody's phones. Like, it's a very social experience. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, because you could all sit around and look at your phone and see what else is up. Oh, man, this looks cool. After we do this, let's go and watch this thing. And then, you know, you just point the telescope and go do it. It's a very communal experience. And I think this is changing star parties. I don't know. I think you have to be physically near the scope to connect your app to it. But
for Wi-Fi,
Yeah, I think you do. And because you have to connect to a specific telescope to for this to work. You know what I wish they would do, Dustin, that I think would sell a lot more of these, is if they had a demo mode in their app that you could download from Play or iTunes, whatever it is, before you decide to buy one, and see what the experience is like. Have a demo mode on it so that you can simulate what it would be like to use the telescope using data that's been actually taken by that telescope. And then you can kind of see for yourself whether you like the app experience, whether you like the way it points the telescope, moves it around one way or the other. Then that'll help you decide too, because the app is basically everything. That's how you're going to interact with this thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's just like having the right expectations going in. Look, this is not going to be a Takahashi refractor with a big CCD camera on it, you know, giving you the images that are going to be getting APODs every day. This is a social experience and a way to explore the universe simply, quickly, and with zero headache. But, you know, don't go in thinking that this is going to be the equivalent of a world-class observatory with a plane wave in it. and all that stuff. It's not. It's just two different things. But going in with the right expectations, it will blow your mind how easy it is. And the image quality is incredible. It really is.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, Eric. Well, I hope that helps. And let us know what you get. let us know and so we can follow along and see how your Star Parties are traveling with this. I think it's a great idea what you're doing. I support what you're doing. I'd also like to know what kind of portable planetarium you have. I used a Star Lab, which I really liked. Okay, so I guess that's it for this episode, Dustin. Hairy week coming ahead. Watch out for JWST. Keeping our sphincters tight and our eyes looking up.
I'll make sure to pop in the stream with you at some point on Christmas Eve so we can see this thing go up, man.
I would love that, man. Yeah, I'll be awesome. There. So, yeah, okay. Definitely send you the invite. So I'll see you guys throughout the week. I'm streaming all of JWST all week long. So we'll talk about it some more. I'll have this episode posted on Wednesday tomorrow so you can listen to it before the launch. Thank you all so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up.
Space Junk is produced by Deep Astronomy and sponsored by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California. Please visit our website at spacejunkpodcast.com. Also, please send any questions and comments or ideas for new episodes to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.